Welcome to the ESRI and the Science of Burr podcast. Utilities are seeing seismic shifts in the industry. Residents are generating their own energy. Monopolies are cracking. With so much at stake, how does an industry cautiously embrace new technology without demolishing some of the oldest infrastructure in the country? Carol Johnston, Vice President of Utilities for IFS, starts with a map.
Being able to summarize complex data into a map that's easy to understand at a glance with color coding. I now have the contextual information with geospatial information brought together in a single tool. It makes all of our lives easier.
Carol Johnston describes to ESRI's John Lenihan how complex systems, like utilities, work from a single source of truth.
Hi, Carol, and welcome to ESRI and the Science Aware podcast.
Hi, thank you, John. Thanks for having me here. Pleasure to be here.
So, Carol, as Vice President of Energy, Utilities, and Resources at IFS, what does that entail?
My primary responsibility is to keep an eye on the macro pulse of what's happening in the energy sector, oil and gas, how they're getting into the power generation business with renewables, and then also utilities, you know, what's happening in terms of business pressures, how they're going through digital transformations. Just keep that macro view of what's happening in the industry and then bring that home to the IFS team so that our marketing teams know how to communicate the language, the empathetic responses we need to come up with when we're talking to that community. But then also, more importantly, to our R&D team, so research and development, to make sure that they're building the right solutions that are going to really have a big impact to the market.
So hundreds of customers use your technology. Location technology and location intelligence is part of it, but I believe there's also still a lot of opportunity to further leverage location technology and location intelligence in asset management and outage management. Can you kind of expand on that?
So a lot of our customers are asking for, I'm doing work in the field, but is it better if I can do a lot of that contextual information, just summarize and show me at a glance, and then maybe I can fill in two data points and have AI or information auto-populated in the form for me so I don't spend half an hour on the side of the road filling it all out. So I think there's a big movement towards less keyboards, more intuitive completion, and more instruction that's given to me in natural language, and I'm not having to work against the technology. The technology is getting to that point where it actually is making my life easier.
And frictionless for the field workers so that it's just part of them doing their job.
Well, yeah. And, you know, think about location technology or maps from, you know, the early days of cavemen, right? So maps have always been that common language that unifies and brings people together to take information into insights. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we went out to hunt buffalo or wildebeest or whatever the animal that was going to be on the menu for the dinner that evening, you know, we would sit in the dirt and draw out maps about where the herd was and the migratory patterns. And, you know, we see that today where I now have the context of the work that I'm doing. You still need to fill in a few data points, but being able to summarize that into a map in the best of the world of contextual information with geospatial information brought together in a single tool. It makes all of our lives easier.
Utilities often have hundreds of systems that essentially operate their business, payroll, asset monitoring, field crews. And in some cases, it can be 5, 10, 15 clicks to get the information. And that's not sustainable, nor is it a really good user experience. So they're dealing with an outage. So how does your company, IFS, and your integrated platform incorporate location technology in what you're offering to the users?
Yeah, and depending on the size of the utility, you can take those tens or hundreds of systems and multiply by five because they have multiple operating companies, they're operating in different states. So it's a very fractured landscape. I'm sure that creates a massive headache for their IT teams in terms of supporting all of that technology, but just as importantly, integrating. So you talked about that I have a job to do, and now I have to integrate data from different systems, extrapolate that into information that I can take action on, and then put that into yet another system that will actually help me do the action that I'm trying to perform. Each of those steps is both inefficient, but it also creates the the fat finger effect as well. If I'm taking data from one and plunking it into another system,
am I introducing errors?
Absolutely. So the approach we take is a very open-ended platform. So we do provide an end-to-end asset lifecycle management platform that can do everything from helping to plan your investments to executing that investment with project management technology, enterprise asset management, integrated geospatial data, mobility, scheduling, dispatch. And that's great if you want to take that whole platform in one big gulp as part of a digital transformation program. But most of our customers don't. They're in different journeys in terms of replacing technology, integrating different tool sets, and they're usually mapping out anywhere from a 10 to 20 year, IT landscape, digital transformation program, and they want to chunk it off in smaller bite-sized pieces. So having an open architected platform that allows you to say, I'm going to take your scheduling and dispatch, and maybe I'm going to migrate my geospatial systems, but I don't want to touch my asset management yet. So being able to integrate that so that you're getting the benefits of data flow and integration without having to do all that data transportation that goes into that.
That's a really good segue to the next question I had, which is about reliability, affordability, trust. How do you build that trust? How do you work with your customers to kind of facilitate that level of collaboration?
Trust is coming up a lot lately in the conversations I'm having, and I think part of it is because of AI and some of these emerging technologies that are so new. It's hard to prove out. I don't think there's a short and easy path to trust. You have to build trust. And you build trust the same as you do in personal relationships, the same way you do with technical relationships. It's by starting maybe with a smaller, easier proof case. So instead of doing the big bang of let's roll it all out 18 months after the project starts, we turn it all on, and then we don't have trust because the system is not performing as we expected. So breaking these large programs down into provable use case where you can actually deploy it quickly, get hands-on feedback. If there's any adjustments that need to be made, you can do those, modify, ensure that you've got the right results coming back. And that's how you build trust over time in systems. Partners, same way. Frankly, a lot of our customers have flat out told me, you may have 80% of the functionality that we were hoping for, but nobody else had it either, so we went with you. But we went with you because we trusted the team we were working with. And you have to trust the software the same way. Like, you have to trust the results it's giving you.
Utilities are very risk averse.
Mm-hmm.
How do you help them overcome that concern or adversity to change?
Yeah, I mean, utilities, there's a lot of other industries, aerospace and defense, that we play in as well that have the same mindset that they're not really rewarded or incentivized to take major risks. Nobody wants to see, hey, the utility rolled out this really innovative, cool new technology and all the lights went off. That's not a good result. No trust is built. So utilities are highly regulated. They're monopolies in the sector. People don't have a lot of choice in terms of who their provider is going to be. So they have to trust that you are going to do the right thing for the right reasons. And keep a focus on what is your primary job. And, the job is clean drinking water and, efficient energy to heat my home and cook my meals from our gas providers and electricity that, powers literally everything in our lives. Being so risk adverse, they have to really think about QA or pre-production environments where you're proving out the stability and the reliability of new software and new technology before you push it out into the broader, production environment and hit customers.
So let's talk about that in the context of digital twins. How do you address concerns with that while building this digital twin? Where's the value?
Yeah, I think digital twins are so important when you're doing that, safe trial and error in an environment that is not your live production environment, right? That's where you should be taking the risks. And digital twins support that. Whether it's something as simple as building a model of a transformer or something as complex as building entire substation model. But then it's great. Now I have all this digital twin. What if I have different sources of the truth, right? So how do I cleanse the data to make sure when I'm relying and I'm making production or mission critical decisions off of the data that my digital twin is telling me, I don't have, again, those hallucinations or different varying outputs from it. So building digital twins, using them to play different simulation and different scenarios before you move that into production, I think is critical, hugely valuable. But you have to put some thought into how are you going to build the model? How are you going to maintain it? How are you going to make sure that it is an accurate reflection of what's happening in the field?
And I like what you said there, the simulation or the what ifs. That's another way to build trust and the adoption.
Absolutely, absolutely. So if you can run a simulation and show to people, like dispatchers is a great example of, you know, technology being viewed as potentially, you know, displacing them. So I think when you build different simulations, if you can prove to dispatchers, if you can prove to users that this is giving a similar or better result than you would have done yourself, and it's doing it in a tenth of the time or a hundredth of the time, and here's the other things you could be doing. Like, here's what you can do with that data. Here's what you can do with that free time. It's not looking to displace you. It's looking to make you a superhero within the organization.
You help big utilities manage their budgets and investments. What's the role of a digital twin of their operations and their assets in imagining a new future?
It really enables a utility to try out different models. Like we see, you know, data centers coming in, load growth is going through the roof, you know, events that are happening that are, you know, not only blowing away old aging infrastructure, but also that brand new wind farm that you just put in has been impacted by this. So if you can model out, you know, what does the next 5 to 10 years look like, and then be able to make your forecasts and plans off of that information, hugely valuable.
So you hit on this a little bit, but the digital twin, aging infrastructure across the U.S. and in Canada, how does a digital twin help manage some of those risks of an ice storm or a hurricane and some of their ability to deliver energy?
Yeah, I mean, if you can model out your operational landscape, like what is the territory I'm managing, where are all my assets, what's their current condition, and then you can model out, you know, what does the floodplain look like? What does it look like if we experience a 1-in-100-year event? What does it look like if it's a 1-in-10-year type flooding event? What assets are likely to be impacted by that? And how could I not only plan to respond to that, but maybe I can also plan of how do I move assets or, you know, prevent or mitigate that risk from happening in the first place? And there's always, like with any insurance, there's always a cost versus risk analysis that you do, right? If it's going to cost me $40 million to replace an asset that if it gets damaged would cost me maybe $10 million. These are the benefits. Sometimes you do nothing, sometimes you do mitigation, and sometimes you do a response scenario.
So then what happens? You've got your service area and you have your assets, you have your customers. Let's say there's a wildfire and, and the utility's delivering gas to 20,000 customers. How's the technology used? How's location intelligence used to help address that, keep the customer safe, but deal with the assets?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And one of our joint customers, Fortis BC, up in the territory that I live in British Columbia, deals with that all the time. So we're right in the heart of wildfire country. And Fortis BC manages infrastructure, not only in the heart of the city, so very urban environment, but they've got lots of rural customers and very, you know, wilderness territory. Being able to model out, you know, where are all their pipelines, where are all their meters, where are all their customer base, and then project the path of the wildfire, which is always unpredictable, but, you know, there is data that can be used based on, you know, weather, lightning strikes, temperatures, humidity levels, and just modeling out the expected path of the wildfire. They can get ahead of that and do their remote disconnect and physical disconnects of the gas so that you don't, you know, interject fire and gas, bad combination.
Yeah.
So do all those disconnects, make that area safe until the wildfire goes through, and then go back in and model out, okay, now I need to see who all did I disconnect, and not waiting for the people to call in and go, hey, my gas is still out. And it's not as simple as you'd think, because you have to go in and not only do the reconnect, but you have to go, you know, relight all the pilot lights and make sure that there's no damage to the infrastructure. So you inject, you know, gas leaks and other risks into the region. And you also have to model out, you know, who are all my customers that I'd previously disconnected for non-pay, and they don't just go back and do a mass, you know, Christmas present to everyone.
And that's with the integrated system. You're bringing data from multiple systems and seeing it in the context of the situation.
On a map, at a glance, I'm getting away from outdated maps and service territories into a digital real-time view of not only my assets, but the status of the customer. And being able to bring that into context of, you know, a digital map and a digital plan for restoration.
I'm very interested in where you see the future of the energy utility resources space in the next 10, 15 years. What should we expect?
Yeah. You know, when we look at, you know, the next 10, 20, 30 years, what does it look like for the utility? Part of it is the changing dynamics of the workforce. I very recently was in talking to one of our customers and met a woman that had been there 60 years, had interned there while she was in high school, graduated from college, went and worked at the utility, sort of done summer internships throughout her teenage years and into her full career. It traditionally, you know, 30, 40 year veterans of the utility was quite common. You got your gold watch, that was your entire career. It was very stable employment. But the world is changing. Like, everybody now wants to be, you know, a remote worker online, an influencer. You know, everybody wants to be leading their own destiny and running their own businesses, and nobody wants to be sort of that traditional tradesperson working in something as important as the utility sector. And you also look at the utility sector, and it's not something that we can overnight go from college to proficient in our first year working for the utility. You don't actually become anything beyond armed and dangerous until you're in your fifth or even 10th year, depending on how high you are in the structure, because you have to go through a lot of, you know, training, knowing, you know, very much the engineering, the design specifications of that utility, how they're operating. If you're wanting to, like, the utility is like no other business on the planet. They all operate very similarly, but it's not like you can compare working at the utility as working at, you know, Maytag or Chevron or any other industry. So it requires very specific knowledge. You know, if I'm looking for a person that can understand and know how to build digital agents, or someone that understands system integrations and all these technical IT roles and jobs, I'm competing now with Microsoft or Google, who's offering 10 times the salary that I can afford as a utility, but I'm looking for the same skills, data scientists, analysts. So the role of technology in not only making that workforce landscape so competitive also has a role in being able to take the tribal knowledge and, you know, automate and digitize workflows and information so that a new hire can have the same skill sets and proficiency as a five-year veteran. I'm not saying it can take and make you the CEO tomorrow, but it can certainly arm them with more information, more safety protocols, guidance, standards, principles baked into a workflow and a software that can extend the workforce while you're looking to backfill all these roles. It's completely fundamentally flipping the business of the utility on its head. The tech providers are getting into the power gen business. So it's not a monopoly any longer in terms of the end-to-end transmission, generation, distribution. And even the consumer themselves are, you know, putting solar arrays on their house. So the traditional tree hugger living off the grid is now the urban yuppie that is now getting into operating and understanding the grid themselves. So I think the nature of the customer and the relationship they have with the utility is fundamentally changing. People understand more and are more concerned with the reliability of the grid. They want to be a part of not only decarbonizing that business, but also understanding how it can support and change all of our lives going into the future. So I really see the grid itself becoming a service. Like, we've seen technology go from enterprise software to software as a service, platform as a service. The utility is really going through that as well. They're providing some of the infrastructure, but they don't own all of the infrastructure any longer. They're charging and maintaining interconnection requests, and they have new partnerships with, you know, Microsoft and Google and Amazon to be able to not only consume and support their data centers and consume the power they're generating, but provide maybe a backup service in times of heavy load, or be able to disconnect them if they need to.
So this idea, we all as homeowners or consumers, we know the idea of off-peak hours for our energy usage. But now you're talking about that at a scale where you're providing it to charging vehicles or a data center, and it's doing that at a much larger scale.
And you need to think about, you know, where do I have surplus capacity and demand, and being able to balance all of that out. It's a different operating model than it ever used to be, but the fundamentals of the grid, where you have to balance supply and demand, has not changed, right? So we just need to think differently about who's supplying, who's demanding, and then operate the grid so that it keeps everybody in harmony and balance.
Carol, thank you so much. This was a great discussion.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening to the Esri and the Science of Work podcast. If you like this episode, please share it with a colleague.